I'm Jonathan Capehart, and today for Leonard Lopate, this is WNYC and WNYC.org. According to data pulled from Google by iQuanti, one of this year's most popular New Year's resolutions was to read more. I am guilty of that. Nearly 4.8 million searched for tips about how to accomplish that goal. Just in time to help achieve it is publishing executive and author Will Schwalbe's Books for a Living. In it, he explains how this love of reading and circumstance led to discovering books that helped him make sense of the world. This is a guide to finding the right book at the right time. It's published by Knopf, and I'm so pleased it brings Will Schwalbe to the show, sitting right across from me. Welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for having me on.
Okay. Finding the right book at the right time. How does one do that? I'm one of those people who makes that New Year's resolution, and I think I've found the book that I want to read, and I'm really into it for about a couple weeks, and then either I find another book to not completely finish, or the book just sits on the nightstand.
Well, I think the magic of books is if you open yourself up to everything that's around you, the right book at the right time will find you. And part of it is just maybe you go hang out in your local bookstore and you see what title catches your eye, or you scan the pages, or you listen to your friends. But there is one really powerful way to find the right book at the right time, and it's so simple, and no one does it.
Okay, you can't leave us hanging like that. What is it?
Ask everybody you meet this one question. Say, what are you reading?
And that is it.
That's it. That's simple.
So you also have this New Year's ritual, and for you, it's buying diet books?
Yes. I buy diet books every, the sort of New Year, New You books. I buy not just diet books, but books to help me deal with all my bad habits and compulsions and obsessions. But I had a realization, which is just as we buy certain kinds of books to improve our physical appearance or our financial health, really it's a great time to sort of say to yourself, I'm going to buy a book to improve myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about traditional self-help books. I'm talking about a wonderful novel that might give you a better sense of empathy, like A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara, or Wonder by R.J. Palacio, the kind of book to make you a better person.
Did you buy any books this year?
Oh, I bought so many books this year.
You want to drop a title or two?
Just bought, and I'm halfway through, The Golden Age by Joan London, which is a fantastic book, Australian writer, set in a home for children with polio. Breathtaking.
Your last book, The End of Your Life Book Club, was about the books you and your mother read together as she was dying. Who selected the books?
Well, we read really the way normal people do. So they were books that were on our night table, books people gave us, books we read about in the paper. And we said to each other all the time that one question, what are you reading? And wound up reading the books that each other suggested. And that's really what I urge. I don't believe in great books programs. I don't believe in setting yourself the task of reading sort of 20 exalted classics. I think you should read where your interests lie, whether it's The Girl on the Train or The Odyssey. That you need to follow your heart and read whatever you like.
Now, you mentioned The Girl on the Train because you have a chapter in your book called The Girl on the Train. What is it about that book that so fascinated you that not only that you read it, that you named a chapter of your book after it?
Well, one of the things that was most important to me when writing books for a living is to acknowledge the fact that there's wisdom to be had in all different kinds of books, that there's wisdom to be had in thrillers as well as cookbooks, children's books, fiction, nonfiction. And what I love about thrillers, and this one in particular, is that thrillers are how you learn who you can trust and who you can't trust. And the great thing about The Girl on the Train, and don't worry, I'm not spoiling anything, is one of the narrators, not only does she not know who she can trust, she's not even sure she can trust herself.
And when you're reading this, it's all about instinct. Were your instincts right? As you're reading this,
My instincts are hopeless, but they get better every time. And and that's one of the great things about Reed. The more you read thrillers, the more finely attuned you get to what kind of symbols and prejudices and other things lead you astray. And there is one lesson I picked up, which is the only person you must never trust is the person who says, trust me.
Well, why? I mean, if you're a trusting soul like I am sometimes, way to a fault, and someone says, trust me, why shouldn't you?
It's like when someone says, can I be honest, in the middle of a conversation?
Right, you they're about to say, like, hammer what,
you've been lying to me the entire rest of the time?
I'm Jonathan Capehart, in today for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Will Schwalbe about his new book, Books for Living. Now, several times in this conversation, you have given the piece of advice of saying, asking someone, what are you reading? And there's more to it than just asking someone, oh, what are you reading, to find out what they're reading. By doing that, you are, and in talking about the books that you are reading, is it a way of sort of amassing a shared vocabulary where two people who might not have any interests in common whatsoever might be able to find a way to have a common vocabulary and a way to talk to each other?
That's a wonderful way of putting it. That's exactly what I would say. That when you ask someone, what are you reading? There's a couple possibilities. One is maybe you're reading the same thing, and then you might think you're in totally different worlds, but you're actually literally on the same page. Or they might tell you about a book you don't know, and then you get to learn about them and learn something about them, or they might ask you. And books have an incredible way of bringing people together, because books are really who we are. And when we read a book, we're a different person at the end of that book than we were at the beginning. And I used to say to people all the time, the best gift you can ever give anyone is a book. But I really think the best gift you can give someone is a conversation about a book.
Yeah, in your introduction, you talk about a grandmother who would talk to her, I believe it was her grandson, on the phone, and have these monosyllabic conversations. Well, monosyllabic from the grandchild.
Yes, exactly.
And she asked, what are you reading?
And it transformed their relationship. The grandson was reading The Hunger Games. She went to the local library. She got The Hunger Games. And the next time they talked on the phone, they were no longer this grandmother pestering her grandson with annoying questions. How was school? What'd you eat? But they were two readers, and they were on a journey, and they were able to talk about what would happen next, and also able to talk about pretty weighty things. Like, if you read The Hunger Games, you talk about war, you talk about the influence of the media, you talk about income inequality and reality television. And so it transformed this grandmother's relationship with her grandson. But I don't even think you need to be related to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I really want us to walk around all day and ask everybody, what are you reading?
Now, what happens if you ask, what are you reading, and the response you get back is nothing?
You have that a lot, and that's fine too. And books aren't for everybody. Some people process information differently. Some people are entirely visual. But it almost always leads to other conversations. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting you asked, or I haven't read anything since school, or I haven't read anything, but I saw a good exhibit at the museum. But one of the things about the question is it takes people seriously. And it encourages a wonderful conversation, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. What about people like me who, I mean, I love when I get into a book, like I'm really into it and I finish it. One book in particular was Cleopatra by Stacy Schiff.
Oh, I love that.
Wonderful,
book.
Wonderful book. But I don't have time. At least I don't think I have
you
time.
You have time. And I'll tell you why you have time.
Okay.
Most people, I think, make the mistake, and it's a very understandable mistake, of trying to read at the end of the night. They have dinner.
Wait, you're not supposed to do that?
Well, the problem is I'm so tired at the end of the night, I can barely read two pages before passing out. But all I do is I set my alarm for a half hour, or if I'm feeling luxurious, an hour earlier, and I lie in bed and I read first thing in the morning. I read before I've gotten a cup of coffee. I just read. And it's the most wonderful way to start the day.
Now, you have this thing about not only lying in bed, but just lying down.
Yes.
And where did this come from?
Well, one of the books that is really one of my touchstones, and I talk about it a lot in Books for Living, is a book called The Importance of Living by Lin Yu Tang. And he was a great writer from the 1930s. This book was a monster bestseller in the 30s. And it's about what he calls the noble art of leaving things undone. And he's huge on the topic of you really need to just chill. You need to lie down. You need to relax. And that's how you find your better self and gain purpose for the day. And I took to that like a duck to water, because my favorite place to be is prone on my bed. So he gave me permission to indulge that.
Well, I mean, as you write, Lin Yu Tang makes a case for loafing, for savoring food and drink, for not striving too much. Lin wanted an antidote. This is what I found most interesting. wanted an antidote to the raw competitiveness and frenetic activity he saw all around him in the early 1930s.
Yes.
I mean, frenetic all around him in the 30s? No, 2017 is crazy in terms of, you know, frenetic activity. What was going on in the 1930s that even then he was telling people to savor, enjoy, loaf, linger?
Well, he, on the one hand, was doing something very charming and at first glance, almost a little frivolous, talking about lying down, loafing, eating food, enjoying friends. But he was writing in the 30s as he saw the rise of fascism and communism across Asia and Europe. And he actually saw greed, ambition, the kind of frenetic life all around him as an immense danger to the world. And he called it out by name. And as he posited it, that kind of greed and ambition symbolized everything inhumane. But reading symbolized everything human. And he urged for this return to the kind of reasonable man. And I just have to tell you one funny story from that. He wrote about a tea house in China in the 30s. And he said everybody was so busy taking pictures of themselves drinking tea that they didn't even enjoy their tea.
Wow. That was in the 30s?
In the 30s.
Oh, I can only imagine what Lin Yutang would say today about 2017. Now, there's another thing that you love to do while lying prone is not just reading, but taking naps.
Oh,
and
yes.
That comes from, it was Haruki Murakami is where
yes,
you
Haruki
get that
Murakami
from?
Haruki Murakami is what I talk about when I talk about running. I mean, one of the things that I write about is the sort of freedom both to misread books or the freedom to find some quirky little thing in a book, even if it's not the point of the book. So on this entire book about running marathons, there's one paragraph that Murakami wrote about the joy of taking naps. And I just fixed on that. So for me, that entire book about marathon running is a book about naps.
But what was it about that one paragraph in that entire book that just spoke to you?
What spoke to me is this idea that running and napping actually are something very similar. That you reach a kind of trance state. There's something that you can do beside other people, but you actually need to really do alone, and that they're restorative. There's something that in this crazy world we live in are both activities that help you get back to yourself.
I'm still not convinced that I have enough time to actually read. Do you, and I know you say you set your alarm a half hour before you need to get going to read. To my mind, a half hour, that's not, by the time you get to 30 minutes, you're like up and running and really into the book. What would you say to me, this hapless lost soul who desperately wants to read, but feels like, you know what, if I start a book, I'm not going to finish it because I don't have time. And so why should I even start the process of doing it?
Well, here's the beauty of that is what could be better than an activity that when you stop it, you desperately want to get back to it. And so much of the things that we do first thing in the morning are grueling. People say, I'm going to wake up first thing in the morning and I'm going to do my email, or I'm going to cook for the day, or I'm going to do something that's grueling, unless you love to cook, and then that's not grueling.
Right.
But to read a book and then to put it down when you still desperately want to know what happens next, that just makes you look forward to the next day. And what could be better than that?
That is true. So then what books do you recommend people read right now?
Well, A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara is an extraordinary, sprawling novel about friendship. Devastating, beautiful. That's one I would definitely recommend. There's a book I talk about a lot in this book, which is Wonder by R.J. Palacio, which is a middle grade reader. It's for fifth graders, but it's for people of any age. And it's really about choosing kindness and being more kind than necessary. A perennial book I recommend is Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, which is great for New Year's resolutions.
Keep going. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I could keep going forever.
give one more, and then I have to ask you about David Copperfield in the little bit of time we have left.
Oh, great. And I would recommend this book I'm reading now, The Golden Age by Joan London. I just think it's an extraordinary book, so that's one I would add to the list.
All right. So you write about the first time you read Charles Dickens' novel, David Copperfield. How old were you?
I was in my late teens.
Mm-hmm. And you say you sobbed when you finished writing the book. Why?
When I finished I had this sense, I so loved the characters. I so loved David Copperfield and Steerforth and Little Emily and Dora. I thought, oh, that's the last I'll ever be able to spend with these characters. They're gone from my life. But then I had this realization that they weren't gone from my life, that actually, thanks to Charles Dickens, I would live with them forever. Mm-hmm. And I talk to them, and they're part of my life. And as I've later lost friends, as we all have, that book has helped me so much because it helps me realize that you can keep people close even when they're not here.
And you also write, there has been something very mysterious about the role that Davids have played in my life. There are lots of Davids in your life. Correct me if I'm wrong. Your best friend was David. You wrote a book about email with a friend named David. Your husband is named David. And then there was your college roommate, David.
Exactly.
What's up with that?
So it's one of those mysterious universe things, and it's the universe telling you things, and you need to listen.
This has been great. I've been speaking with Will Schwalbe. His latest book is Books for Living. Thanks so much for joining us today. And I'm going to try my best to finish SPQR by Mary Beard. It's been on my nightstand I'm like halfway through, but I am going to finish it in 2017. Will Schwalbe, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jonathan.
You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org.